Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, it's Jesse Green. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It's great to have you here for another episode of the show. Today we're having an important conversation, I believe, about the importance of 2ICs or practice managers or chief operating officers or whatever language you want to use in your practice, but essentially your loyal lieutenant. And my guest today is Shirley Dalton, and she's had an incredible background in her own career as a 2IC, as a loyal lieutenant, and she's worked with large companies such as Kip McGrath and many others as well. And she's really passionate about helping that 2IC, that loyal lieutenant, become an integral and valuable part of the practice. So in this podcast, we talk a lot about how to identify those people. How do we know who's going to be the right fit for that role? What sort of attributes should they have? And if they're not on our team already, how do we find them? And then once we've found them, how do we work with them? How do we get the best out of them? How do we help them do what they do best and let them thrive? And really, as a business owner, how do we kind of get out of the way and let them do just that? But also knowing that we have those guardrails in place. And so this conversation is a really interesting one, and Shirley is a wonderful guest, and you can find out, you know, her work at shirleydalton.com.au, and she's got a wonderful book called The Loyal Lieutenant, and I'd encourage you to grab a copy of it. It's a wonderful read, and you can find it on her website, and it's going to be a valuable resource for you and your practice manager to get stuck into and to digest. So without any further ado, here's Shirley. Shirley Dalton, welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. Great to have you here. How's things in Newcastle?
Very good. We've been expecting a lot of rain and we've been moving over the last week or so, but we've been very fortunate that the rain has held off. It's a beautiful day today.
Well, actually here in Canberra is the first bit of sun we've seen for a while too, and I'm thinking of all those people in flood-affected areas, so our thoughts and prayers are with you all. You are really well known for your work in helping 2ICs or loyal lieutenants, as you say, step into a role of leadership. And of course, you've written a book about that, of course, which is a wonderful book. And the book is called The Loyal Lieutenant, How the Second in Command Brings the CEO's Vision to Life. And so I really wanted to spend today talking about the role of that 2IC, the loyal lieutenant, and how to get the most out of that person and how for them to get the most out of the role. But I wanted to ask you about the role of 2IC and why it's such an important and pivotal role in any organization, but particularly an organization that's growing. You know, there's a lot to be learned and gained from just getting a good understanding of that. So I wondered if we could kick off our conversation with that, please.
So the role of the COO or the second in command, chief operating officer, general manager, every organization has a different term for it, but it's the person who pops up and is the person who solves the problems. It's the person that the business owner trusts. When they go away, they know this person's looking after the business. And it is so important because often the business owner is the person who's got the vision and they can see where they're going and where the business is going. And the majority of us don't. And in fact, I really like Simon Sinek's work around vision, where he says that the person with the vision can see the starting of an iceberg while it's way under the water. And then when it just starts to peak over, we still can't see it. And then we have to wait until it's this great big iceberg before we go, oh, oh, that's what you mean. So the CVO, as he says, Chief Vision Officer or CEO, they have the vision of where they want it to go, and particularly if they're growing, they can see, yep, I want more clients or I want more businesses or more outlets. They need the second in charge as their interpreter, somebody who can see that vision and then take that down and interpret that and then give instructions and basically project manage for the rest of the team in order to make that happen.
I really love that because, you know, in the Savvy Dentist organization, I have a loyal lieutenant and, you know, he makes my life like a million times easier. He's able to make sense of my scrambled ideas because what seems clear to me, as you say, gets lost in translation quite easily, as it turns out. And I'm going, well, what's, yeah, anyway. But, you know, I really endorse that. And from a CVO or a CEO's point of view, this particular person on my team, I couldn't operate without. And if I did try, and I have tried in the past, it usually ends in tears, mine and theirs. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about the difference between a really fully fledged COO and someone in a dental practice who might be the practice manager, and are they the same thing? Are they not the same thing? And yeah, I'd like to just talk a bit about that for a second, if you've got any experience with that, because there's a few, I guess, essential roles that a COO will do that maybe a practice manager won't do, and I'm just curious to explore those differences.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We travelled around America for a number of months, and that's when I got introduced to the terminology of what they call the C-suite. Mm. I'm like, what's a C-suite? And I found out that it's the chief of. Mm. So it's the chief operating officer, the chief executive officer, the chief finance officer. And when we look at the chief operating officer, it's the person who is looking after all of the operations. So in the practice, that could well be the practice manager. Mm. Because it's, for me, the COO, the chief operating officer, the practice manager, the general manager, those terms are all interchangeable. It's the second in charge role that they are performing. So they're the person that the business owner or the CEO, CBO trusts and treats like a confidant, and that they won't tell the rest of the staff, you know, some of their plans and ideas. But this relationship is a special relationship. You know, they're trusting, they're sharing. And then the second in command has the first in command's back, if you like, and then understands them and then understands the team and how to get things done.
Yeah. I really like the fact that you've identified that it is a very important and special relationship. And I think from the practice owner's point of view, or you know, the CVO's point of view, you want to be able to have that space where you can speak freely and openly, and you need to be able to sometimes have that space to just share whatever's on your mind, good, bad, or indifferent, and know that it's in the vault, right? It doesn't need to be shared. It's just I hate to use the word safe space because it just feels very PC and psychologically, I don't know, weird for me, but I can't think of a better word, but a safe space where you can say the things you need to say and go, okay, I just need to get that off my chest now, let's get back to it kind of thing. Is that part of that relationship, you think?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very trusting relationship, and you are able to vent. As the practice owner, you do need that because it's lonely. It's very lonely at the top. And, if you don't have somebody that you can talk to, then it makes it very difficult. And what I've also found too with a lot of business owners is, and particularly men, is that they don't want to burden their family or their wives. And of course, then it's not cool to go to the pub and say, oh, this is what's happening at the business. So they don't say that either. So having that loyal lieutenant is a key position and a key relationship.
So I think we can all appreciate that there's a huge amount of value in finding that right lieutenant, that key person there to work alongside you. How do you find or identify that person? Because that person might be already on your team, or maybe we need to go and find someone to come into the team if we don't have that person. So there's probably people in the team who fit that role, but maybe they haven't identified themselves, or maybe the business owner hasn't identified them. How do we identify them? And if we can't identify them, how do we find them?
Yes. Well, if they're in the business already, you'll know them because, as one of my clients said, the cream always rises to the top. And as an example, this business owner, he wanted to travel, go around Europe, etc. And he noticed that each time he went away, there was one particular person who used to just pop up and take control of the business while the owner was away. He hadn't been asked to do that, but he just would pop up and do it. He would know everything that was going on. He would talk to the owner and tell them different things, you know, give them the feedback. And you'll find, Jesse, that there are people like that in most organisations. Mm-hmm. There is somebody who just seems to rise to the top. They come in early, they go late. Not that I'm a great proponent of that, because in my systems work, some people do that, but but they waste all of their time at work. But but we're talking about dedication and commitment here. You know, they're there for the company and for the practice owner. And if we don't have somebody like that, then these are the qualities that we're looking for if we're going to recruit externally. And you can put out for a practice manager, you could put out for the second in charge general manager, etc. But it's really these qualities that we're looking for in the people, not necessarily all of the skills and experience.
How do you actually test for that though, Shirley? Because one of the things that I've certainly found, and I'm aware others have found, and I presume it's relatively common, is sometimes you read the CV. Yeah, everyone's CV looks good. Most of them are professionally written. And so how do you test for those sorts of qualities in an interview type process? Because we talk about culture fit, and part of our culture is to have that initiative and drive and that kind of internal motivation. But how do you test that? How do you try before you buy?
Yes. Well, we know that interview is the least reliable form of recruitment because people tell you what they think you want to hear rather than what's necessarily truth. What we do, so I would recommend a lot of testing. So testing of, if it's a skill-based thing, testing of the skills. If it's an attitude-based thing, then there are a number of profiles that you can use. One of the best ways, though, Jesse, is to ask them what they've done before, because past behaviour is the best indicator of future behaviour. So I wouldn't be asking hypothetical questions like, oh, what would you do if this happened? Because that's easy to give a textbook answer. But you would ask something like, can you tell me about a time in detail when you had a problem at work and you had to solve it? What was the problem? How did you solve it? What was the outcome?
Okay. So there's the questioning, there's the what would you do, you know, if you had, not the hypothetical, but tell me about a time when. But what about this testing? I'm curious to explore testing. Are there, you know, there's obviously all manner of different tests around, there's all manner of different personality types and behavioural styles. Are there any that lend themselves more to a 2IC role, or can any behavioural style step into a 2IC role?
With the right value set and attitude, anybody can step into it and they can be taught. So I'm talking about things like responsibility and accountability. So some people naturally have that in spades. Other people need to be taught that to understand what it means to have responsibility or to take responsibility rather than, you know, I'm sure you're aware of the old above and below the line, you know, ownership, responsibility, accountability, or getting into bed with blame, excuses and denial. So we have a particular profile, which is not a personality profile. So your personality profile is about how you habitually behave, how you think, how you feel and how you act. But this one that we use is called Integrity and Values, and it was developed in Australia by Jennifer Elliott. And it actually can give us a score for your truthfulness, responsibility, accountability, loyalty and self-awareness, which is what the workplace employers and employees said are the most important values that we want to see. And so we can get a score between 1 and 10 for those. The higher the score on responsibility means the easier it is to coach someone, and also they'll take responsibility and ownership. The lower the score, then they're just going to come to you with all the reasons why it's not their fault. And accountability, I've seen if it's a low score on accountability, they'll often have difficulty saying no. If it's too high on accountability, and particularly if it's low on responsibility, then they're cracking the whip on everybody else, but they're not really taking ownership for themselves.
Yeah.
And this profile, we use it for recruitment, and we use it for coaching purposes, but it, unlike a personality that doesn't change much over time, this one's at a point in time of where you are. And it gives us a great insight. You know, there's other things within it, but it gives us a great insight into who the person is.
And I guess if that is a moment in time snapshot, then it does lend itself to improvement in different areas and so on and so forth. And that would be an internal development process, presumably within the business, to help people level up in certain areas.
I just this morning went through a debrief session for our next leadership experience, and they get this as part of their package, and understanding how they're showing up. And like, say somebody has got a lower truthful score, it doesn't mean that they tell porky pies necessarily. What it means is that they withhold. And then when they withhold, then we can't really know what's going on. And some people are like people pleasers, so they'll just say yes, but that's not what they really think. And after a while, we can't really trust them because they're not actually speaking up.
Yeah, and therefore you get, you know, back to, is it Lencioni's, you know, five dysfunctions of a team, you know, trust being the foundational one. If we're not being able to speak freely or people-pleasing or whatever it is, that trust is eroded and then it's really hard to build an effective team after that. Just wanted to ask you a bit about if you're lucky enough to have two people on the team and how do you manage that without feeling like you're neglecting the other or favouring one over the other? Is it simply a matter of saying, hey, this is a joint role or dividing responsibility? You've got this part of the ship and you've got that part of the ship, or how do you manage that?
Yes, well, if you make everybody responsible for something, you make
nobody's.
Yeah. So, and I saw this in a great example was when I was working with Kip McGrath and his wife Dagnia, and I was the COO for them, and Kip and his son Storm were responsible for running the business and for sales and advertising and marketing, and then Dagnia was responsible for the curriculum because it was a franchise for tutoring kids. And they had their areas of responsibility, and you know they could often go up into the boardroom and have a big biff up over it. But at the end of it, they'd come out and say, "Right, this is the decision. This is what we're doing." And the staff knew who to go to for what. Mm. And I think that's a really key thing. So if you've got two people, it's really important to make sure that they have that swim lane, a lot of people call them. Now, you need to be careful with swim lanes too, because people can get so scared that they're crossing into someone else's swim lane that they actually don't say anything and they don't speak up. So, you know, we know that not speaking up is a kiss of death for a team. So my recommendation would be, as best as you can, give them their responsibilities, their own swim lanes, and then educate everybody. This is who you go to for this. However, also empowering them that if they do see something in somebody else's swim lane, then, you know, as an executive team, we have a meeting and discuss the issues.
The COO, where do they fit into the executive team? Are they leader of that executive team? Are they part of that executive team? How do you build an executive team? So the reason I'm asking this question, Shelley, just to give you context, is listening to this podcast, we're going to have practice owners, dental practice owners who are relatively early in their stage of business journey. They may or may not yet have a practice manager. So this is going to be really cool to start thinking, well, how do I get one and who am I looking for? But then we've got people who are doing we've got eight-figure business owners listening to this that their needs are more complex and they're going to need a leadership team. So how does this structure work in terms of leadership teams? Where does the COO or the loyal lieutenant sit in that structure and the other roles that might be in play?
Jesse, it fundamentally comes back to how much involvement the practice owner wants. Mm. So if the practice owner doesn't want to be leading and managing and supervising the rest of the executive team, then you put the second in charge, the practice manager, in between. So if you were looking at an org chart, you'd have the practice owner, you'd have the practice manager, and then you might have the team leaders. Mm. And collectively, they might form the executive team. And again, that sort of reinforces that special relationship between the practice manager and the practice owner. Mm-hmm. If, however, we don't have enough resources and the business isn't that big, then the practice manager can sit on the same line, if you like, with the other team leaders. However, it's still implied that they are like the senior team leader, if you like.
Yes. Mm. So in a dental practice, you might have your practice manager and then you might have, for example, a head of front of house. So you might have a reception coordinator or what we'd call a front office coordinator. Then you might have a clinical coordinator or whatever it is. And those team leaders, along with the practice manager, might form the executive team, basically. Cool, mm-hmm. cool. Okay, excellent. So I wanted to ask you about getting this executive team right. And again, I know that people will be thinking, okay, well, I've kind of got some of this structure in place and that's really good. One of the things that I know that some dentists struggle with is, you know, is this really just giving people a title? Is this kind of just giving people a name to feel good so they can put it on their, you know, uniform and feel great about it? What are the tangible benefits, really, is what I'm asking, that come to the practice owner and to the practice more broadly and indeed to the customers or the patients in this case that are going to be the real payoffs for this?
It depends on how much authority comes with the title.
Mm.
And by that, I mean some practice owners still want to hold on to all of the decision making.
Mm.
And in that case, then the title doesn't really mean anything because people know, well, you know, you've got this fancy title, but we've still got to go to the owner to get a yes or a no. And that's one of the challenges for practice owners is to be able to let go and to delegate and to give out what we call delegated authority. So criteria for the things that the practice manager can make decisions on without having to go to the owner of the business. Now, that could be certain budget. It could be resources, you know, like they can work that out within their own business. Well, I always remember Kip saying to me one time when he was offering me a promotion, he said, you know, a good title is worth $10,000, Cheryl. I said, forget the title, I don't care what you call me.
Yeah,
give just me the 10,000.
Give me the 10 grand. Yeah, exactly. Thanks very much. Oh, that's hilarious. So delegated authority, can we just understand and explore that a little bit, because there's some nuance in that definition of delegated authority as opposed to just delegation of tasks.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by delegated authority? What's the difference between that and just regular delegation?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll give you an example. If you go to some of the really good hotels,
yes,
they have delegated authority for their frontline staff that if a customer is unhappy about anything, then they can make a decision on what they can do to make that customer happy. So they may be able to spend up to $500 or up to $2,000 to fix the problem.
Mm.
Or they may be able to make a decision that we will change their room or we will give them an extra night's accommodation. So that's delegated authority. Mm. Where you've been delegated that you can now make these decisions within this criteria, as opposed to delegating, here's the task that you're responsible for, go and make the customers happy. Well, okay, what am I going to do for that? Yes, I've got to greet them nicely, I've got to follow the systems, etc. But I can't make a decision if a customer comes and says, I'm not happy about this room, it stinks of cigarette smoke. I'm sorry, I'll just have to go and talk to my supervisor. Supervisor, oh, I'm sorry, I'll have to go and talk to the manager.
Mm.
I'm sorry, I'll have to go, which, you know.
Yeah, becomes unpleasant from the guest's point of view and you feel like you're going around in circles. I think that's really important. And I guess one of the things that I'm picking up here, Shelley, is that there'll be people at frontline that have certain skills, certain knowledge that perhaps the managers don't have as well because of their direct experience with what they're dealing with. And I guess what I'm hearing is we're moving some decision-making to where the knowledge lies. Is that a reasonable assertion?
Mm, absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So if one of the problems is that business owners jump in, don't give it, you know, they delegate tasks rather than delegate authority. They want to hang on to the reins. Dentists are notoriously perfectionistic. I like to use the word control freaks, that maybe that's a little bit tough sometimes. But in essence, we care very much about details. We're very much trained to be detail-oriented. That's the nature of our clinical work, and probably personality-wise, we're all cut from that cloth. So letting go of control involves huge amounts of trust in the sense that things need to be done to a particular standard. So I want to just talk about maintaining standards along with delegation of authority. How have you seen that work? And can you share with me some examples where you've seen that work or maybe some examples where it hasn't worked so well?
It comes down to accountability.
Yeah.
So, and you get to set the standard.
Yeah.
So, for example, when we set up, we call them key performance indicators and key behaviour indicators rather than job descriptions because they set down the tasks that have to be done to what standard. Most people, when they come to work, they want to know, what do I have to do to what standard to succeed in the role? train me in that and then leave me to it so I don't have to be micromanaged. So when we set those up, say, for example, reception. So answer the phone within three rings using the company script. So they either do or do not. Mm. And that makes it easier for the supervisor then, because if they don't know how to do it, I can train you how to do it. So it comes back down to you set the standard, you provide the training, and then that gives you a level of comfort that if they do this according to this standard, then I can trust you to do the job.
Mm.
Okay. And here's another one. I keep referring to Kip, but he was one of my greatest mentors. If staff don't give you what you want, either you didn't give good instructions or they're incompetent. And if they're incompetent, is it because they're unable or unwilling? And if unable, do they need more training?
Mm.
So two out of three there is on our responsibility. Mm. Instructions and training and resources. And if we've covered off on those, then it's an unwilling, which is a different conversation.
Mm.
So what I find too is that, we're getting into a little bit of the mindset stuff here with the owners, is that I've worked with people that only I can do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's got to change because, you know, they're not the only one. In fact, you asked for some examples. I had one who was a real estate principal. And, you know, only I can do it, only I can do it. These staff are hopeless. And that, you know, and of course they had the revolving door of people coming and going. And I said to him one day, I said, "You're in a franchise, aren't you?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "How much money do you pay to the franchise or for, you know, the business?" And he goes, "Oh, too much money. I don't even want to think about it." And I said, "Hmm." And I said, "And where would you be if they had the opinion that only they could do it?"
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a sobering thought, isn't it?
Yeah. If you want to grow your practice, you really have to get out of the way yourself.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And we sometimes talk about, you know, a couple of different things. And one is you've got to be able to, you know, work through other people to achieve those goals. And I mean that really elegantly, not in a negative sense. You've got to be able to, you know, bring the best out of others, you know, set that vision and set them free. And the other thing, it was a really nice quote. One of our clients shared this the other day and I thought it was really good. He said he could solve more problems with his brain than he could with his hands. So for him to grow his practice, he needed to stop solving problems doing dentistry.
Yes.
And learn to use his brain to equip his team better and let them solve problems with their hands. And I thought that was really, really just an elegant way of saying it. Shirley, I wanted to ask you a little bit about formalizing this 2IC role and why that's important, because you've said already that sometimes we don't identify people in the role. Maybe they don't even recognize themselves in the role. So what's the big deal of making this formal and making it known?
There's a couple of benefits to that. One is that the rest of the team know who to go to.
Mm.
And they also know that if that person makes a decision, then that person has that authority to make it.
Mm.
So there's less challenging of the decision. There's less going around to the boss, which saves the boss's time. And it also brings out a confidence in the loyal lieutenant, because often they're just doing this, the work, out of who they are. They just find problems, they fix problems, they solve problems. Nobody asks them to do it. Once you recognize that and then you make it formal, it's a real confidence boost. And some people actually will actively resist. No, I'm not. I just do this. But when you actually do formally recognize it and give them the title, whatever that is in the organization, they actually do step in and put that loyal lieutenant's jacket on, and they actually blossom and grow even more.
That's fantastic. You know, one of the things that I really believe is there's so many resources around for business owners. I mean, if you're a business owner, there's a dearth of resources to help you become a better business owner, better visionary, better this, better that. But I do sometimes feel like the 2IC, the loyal lieutenant, sometimes there's not enough resources to help them step into that role. So I really wanted to say thank you for writing your book, Shirley. I think it is a really wonderful resource. And for everyone listening to the podcast, I think that, you know, grab a copy of the book, give it to your practice manager or the person you identify on your team as that person is going to step into that role. But Shirley, what I'd really like to ask is, once people read the book, what would be the two or three key steps that you think a practice owner can and should do, or indeed a loyal lieutenant can and should do, to really, as you say, put on that jacket, to take ownership of that role and step into it? What would be two or three things that you think either the business owner or the loyal lieutenant themselves can and should be doing?
Well, one of the reasons that I wrote the book was actually for some of my clients who are loyal lieutenants. And one of them works in an accounting practice. And anyway, the boss flew to Melbourne and read the book. And of course, the loyal lieutenant read the book, which shows how valuable they are. And when the boss came back, he said, now I know what you should be doing. And she said, yes. And now you know how valuable I am.
Excellent.
And so from there, they then formalised her position and they did actually make her the COO. And she was so nervous. She had to address the team to say, yes, I'm stepping into this. And she said, you know, she could hardly speak. She was sweating. And then after a couple of weeks, she's really grown into this position. And now, you know, it's formal. Everybody knows that she's the person you go to. She's providing that great support for the owner of the business, and there is that key relationship so the business can grow.
Great. So if you were to give the loyal lieutenants one or two pieces of advice after reading the book, what would be the first one or two steps for them?
The first step is for them to actually try on their jacket and say, you know, can I accept this role? Can I accept this jacket? And if that's the case and they're comfortable to do that, then I would go to the owner and say, you know, I've just read this book and this is the outline of what the loyal lieutenant does. I think I do that. Could we look at formalising that in some way? Can I help relieve you of some of the stress and the burden by having that delegated authority?
And I reckon every business owner is going to say, thank goodness. Yes, yes, yes. Let me give you stuff. I love it. Shirley, lots of really good threads of conversation today. Of course, your book is available on your website, which is shirleydalton.com/books. For people who want to get a copy of the book, do go ahead and grab a copy. I think it'll be a wonderful read for your practice manager. So don't just get a copy for yourself. Get a second copy for your practice manager, read it together, and then I would say come back and talk about what you learned and what you thought about the elements of the book there and start working on an action plan. So just, again, that web address is shirleydalton.com/books. Grab a couple of copies and get stuck into it. Shirley, thank you. I've really enjoyed talking to you because I do think this is a neglected part of business in general, and I do think that the loyal lieutenant needs support, right? If they're going to support the business owner, I think they need their own support network as well. So thank you for writing the book and thank you for the work that you do.
Yeah, thank you, Jesse. And I just want to add too that in the book there is actually practical exercises to help the loyal lieutenant actually systemize and document the systems within the business. So it's not purely about the mindset of the loyal lieutenant. There's actually practical ways for them to actually improve and streamline the processes.
Well, that'll be fantastic as well. So the business operates like clockwork, just consistency day in, day out. So again, that and a well-run, well-managed team equals great leverage, and love it. Thanks again, Shirley.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.